I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. This morning, our guest is Jonathan Kaufman, author of The Last Kings of Shanghai and Pulitzer Prize-winning head of the journalism department at Northeastern University. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's Labor Day weekend, which in many parts of the country is the last hurrah of summer, but here in the Sonoran Desert, where I live, Labor Day is just a brief interruption in an already busy fall schedule. Long before this holiday became another excuse for a three-day weekend, Labor Day was a significant statement about the value of a human being's hard work. When it started, the very concept that labor had value, morally and economically, was controversial, as it remains in some quarters today. Labor Day was created in the 1880s to support the working man and working woman, and as an expression of the importance of organized labor in America. It was a way of saying labor mattered. Capital wasn't the only positive value in the U.S. economy or society. Now, we Jews have always believed labor has moral quality. One of the great sentences in Pirkei Avot, the ethics of our ancestors, says, Al shlosha devarim ha'olam omed, al ha'torah ve'al ha'avodah ve'al gemilut chasadim. The world is based on three things, on Torah, on work, and on acts of selfless kindness. The Hebrew word avodah, labor, can mean religious service, but typically it means practical, prosaic work. It is likely that the connection of labor to divine service is intentional. In other words, honest work is literally a form of prayer. This exaltation of basic labor as the foundation of society and a way to serve God is consistent throughout Jewish tradition. You might not be aware that until fairly recently, being a rabbi wasn't even a paying profession. Most of the great rabbis and scholars in Jewish history had day jobs, from Rabbi Yossi Hassandlar, a shoemaker in the days of the Talmud, to Rashi, who was a wine merchant in the Rhineland in the 11th century, to Maimonides, a very active and super busy physician in the 12th century in Spain and North Africa and Egypt, to the rabbis of Eastern Europe who made a living in the lumber trade or worked as butchers. For Jews, there has never been any shame in hard work. In fact, a movement based on exalting work, the labor Zionists created the State of Israel. The first immigration of Jews coming back to Israel in the 19th century was made up of idealistically motivated labor Zionists. What today we would call, well, they were socialists. They created the institutions of the modern State of Israel, including the Histadrut, the labor union-based organization that still has enormous influence in Israeli daily life. Until the late 1970s, every single prime minister of Israel came from the Labor Party. Its influence in the Knesset has eroded steadily since. It's almost gone. But the mythos of Israel is deeply imbued with exaltations of labor and work. Early Zionist songs included lines like Hechalutz leman avodah, avodah leman hechalutz. The pioneer lives for the sake of work. Work is there for the sake of the pioneer. And of course, one of the great old institutions of Israeli life, the kibbutz, which did more to shape the character and reputation of Israel internationally than virtually anything, it's based on labor. Here in America, many important labor organizers, from Samuel Gompers to Emma Goldman, were Jewish. Gompers, who was the founder and longtime president of the American Federation of Labor, the AFL, part of the AFL-CIO, said Labor Day differs in every essential way from the other holidays of the year in any country. All other holidays are connected with conflicts and battles of man's prowess over man, of strife and discord for greed and power, of glories achieved by one nation over another. Labor Day is devoted to no one, living or dead, to no sect, race, or nation. Abraham Lincoln said, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor, could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much the higher consideration. A personal note on the subject of labor, my own maternal grandparents, my Zadie Lou and Bubby Dora, were members of a group called the Workman's Circle, the Arbeiterring, socialists who didn't believe in God, really, but certainly believed in Jewish life and the value of labor and workers. I used to do a Pesach Seder for the Arbeiterring every year that managed to make no mention of God somehow, but was otherwise about as traditional as you could imagine. Except Moses came off as a union organizer. Without making this a commercial for look for the union label, it's important to remember that in Jewish tradition, avodah, work, labor, retains a high innate value. And we should especially consider that over this Labor Day weekend. I am particularly tuned into it this Labor Day, having just completed teaching a series on the history of Zionism. Remember, the State of Israel was founded in large part through the dramatic efforts of those labor Zionists, socialists who believed in the value of hard labor. It was their incredibly hard, dedicated work that built a nation out of a wilderness of swamps and deserts. So, my friends, enjoy Labor Day weekend. Take a break from work, as, you know, we all do here in America, but appreciate just how much is accomplished solely through hard work in this world. What's that old platitude? Genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. You know, that quote is usually attributed to that old anti-Semitic inventor, Thomas Edison, but in fact, it was actually invented by a woman named Kate Sanborn in the 1890s. Whoever said it, it's true. It's work that makes things happen. And this weekend, we can appreciate that fact. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a classic song from the early days of Israel, the really hard-working days, Shir Boker, Morning Song. The words include, we shall plant and build up on your wastelands, beautify your borders and your plains.
Ma odona
That was Shir Boker. Anu ohavim otcha moledet besimcha beshir uveamal. We love you, land of our birth, in joy, in song, and in labor. Our guest this morning, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jonathan Kaufman, has written great nonfiction books about Jewish subjects and other things. His latest book illuminates incredible stories about the Jews who helped shape modern China. It's called The Last Kings of Shanghai. Meet Jonathan Kaufman when we come back in just a moment right here on Too Jewish.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
A great new class for everyone. This Is Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but didn't get to ask. Who was Abraham? What is the Torah? How long have Jews been around? In three fun, informative sessions, This Is Judaism brings the joy of Jewish life and learning to you. Rabbi Sam Kohan teaches what Jewish values, spirituality, and community are all about. All classes are open to everyone, Jewish or not. Best of all, This Is Judaism is completely free, but you must pre-register. Want your kids to understand Jewish heritage, history, and holidays? Want to try tasty Jewish food? Then This Is Judaism is for you. The classes are free, but you must pre-register. Call 520-276-5675. Visit BeitSimchaTucson.org or email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. This Is Judaism is taught on three consecutive Sundays or three consecutive Wednesdays this fall live with a Zoom option. There's no obligation and it's completely free. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Jonathan Kaufman is a very distinguished director of journalism at Northeastern University, has written three terrific books. One of them, I think my favorite book about what happened in Eastern Europe, Hole in the Heart of the World. His most recent book is The Last Kings of Shanghai. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thanks very much. I'm happy to join you.
So I served, just a little bit of sort of self-serving stuff, I served as a rabbi for the High Holidays in Shanghai. I think it's 2018 or so. And they talk about the different Jewish communities of Shanghai, because there was one going back to the Silk Road times, and then that disappeared. And then there's the extraordinary community that you write about in The Last Kings of Shanghai, and that kind of disappears at the time of Mao, and then there's this new expat community there now. But the one that you wrote about is remarkable. Tell us what led you to that story.
Well, I was a journalist. I was a foreign correspondent, and I was based in China and visited China a great deal. And at one point during one of my visits to Shanghai, I had to use the bathroom. And I went into the Peace Hotel, which is right on the Bund, that great Art Deco street. And I went inside, and it was like walking into a 1930s movie. I mean, this was early on in the late 70s, early 80s. It was still Red China. Everybody wore those Mao suits, we remember.
Right.
Far more bicycles than cars. And I went into this hotel, and there were beautiful marble floors, windows. I asked a bellhop came up to me, and I asked him where the bathroom was, and he responded to me in French. And I remembered walking out thinking, what in God's name is a hotel like this doing in the middle of communist China? Right. And, you know, someone told me it had been built by a Jewish playboy millionaire in the 1920s, and that at one point he had been the richest man in Shanghai. And the second richest family had been another Jewish family, the Fedoris. And so you hear a story like that, and I just began to think, as a reporter, what's going on here? I knew all about, you know, Jews in Eastern Europe. We all know the story of Fiddler on the Roof, and that's where the world, many of our families came out of. But this story was a very different one. It started in Baghdad, and it came through China. And I just wanted to find out what this history was for Jews, but also for the Chinese.
I omitted the famous Shanghai ghetto during the war, when lots of Austrian and other Jews from Germany and so forth came to Poland, came to Shanghai and were there, but again, just for a few years. But the Sassoons and Katuris were a completely different experience for China. We will talk much more with Jonathan Kaufman. And from that bathroom to a remarkable story in The Last Kings of Shanghai, we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer and fall. Established nearly 6 years ago by great congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the Catalina foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school is starting. Well, guess it started already. For school-aged children or grandchildren, you can still join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Torah Tikes experience, bar and bat mitzvah programs, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with fabulous Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. Beit Simcha services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Friday night services are at 6:30 p.m., always followed by a delicious Oneg Shabbat. Shabbat morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., with services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our musical services are available there and, of course, in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. You can find out about those. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, including our new This Is Judaism series, all taught live and on Zoom, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, Kvetch or Kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O JewishRadio18 at Gmail. Or go to our website, TooJewishRadio.com, T-O-O JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating. Review Too Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation.
known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, you're going to be going to one of your favorite places and most interesting places, leading a tour of Vienna, where you lived for a good amount of time.
More than 5 years.
Yes. Vienna has a very complicated Jewish history. Many famous Jews come from there. Theodor Herzl, Sigmund Freud, you know, like people that are everyday household names for anybody Jewish. And yet it's also, in some ways, the birthplace of the most virulent...
Mahler, Schoenberg,
right. I'm a musician. I should have started there. Vienna's a fantastic musical city still. I went to the opera there. It was unbelievable. But it was also the birthplace of some of the most virulent anti-Semitism in human history. Tell us a little bit about how you would describe what happened in Vienna, the importance of the Jewish community there, and its impact over time.
Sure. It's a very complicated and very long-lived story. So we may have to devote more than one session to this.
We can do that. We have that capacity on Too Jewish.
Let's go back no further than the time of the Crusades. Vienna was the capital of a dynasty called the Babenbergers, and a few hundred years later became the capital of a dynasty called the Habsburgs.
The Habsburgs,
who
of course.
Have been there ever since.
Right.
And it was the headquarters or the capital of a huge multinational, multi-ethnic, multilingual empire. It wasn't only Austria and Hungary, which we all know, but it was what today is the Czech Republic, the Czechia,
yeah.
What today is Slovakia, what today is Croatia, Slovenia. Much of northeastern Italy.
It had a fair amount of Germany in it too at times, you know. It
just- yeah. Or Bohemia, which was German-speaking
right.
part of Czechia.
Right.
You know, it's complicated. And also, cities that are in today's Ukraine or southern Poland, like Krakow or Lviv. Lviv was Lemberg. And if you buy a ticket on Austrian Airlines, it still says Lemberg.
Right.
Just like in northeastern Italy, there's a town called Bolzano in Italian. But in German or Austrian, it's Bozen. So if you buy an Austrian airline ticket from Vienna...
To Bolzano,
it says Bozen on it, and you have to know the German, or you don't know if it's the right ticket. So Vienna was this huge, always cosmopolitan, multi-ethnic capital, but it was the capital of a Catholic country, and the rulers were closely aligned with the Roman Catholic Church. And as was the case in virtually every Catholic country in Europe, there was a lot of institutionalized anti-Semitism that didn't always erupt into pogroms or expulsions, but it did every century or two in Vienna, as elsewhere. And Jews had a pretty rough history. It was a real roller coaster ride in the years between, let's say, 1000 of the Common Era and 2000 of the Common Era.
Okay, that's a long time, by the way.
Right. Over 1,000 years. And there is, not coincidentally, not one, but two Jewish museums in Vienna. There are lots of old synagogues, some of which are still in use. The community is growing slowly because of immigration from Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, mostly. It's also still a very international city because a lot of UN organizations have their headquarters there. The organization for which I worked for 5 years, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, has its headquarters in Vienna. In fact, its like weekly big heavy meeting was in the Hofburg, which was the royal palace.
Yeah.
So my exposure to Vienna is maybe too deep for this discussion, but let's talk about what happened in the 19th and 20th centuries, because that's probably of the most interest, and I guess we'll have to do that next week.
We will. Tom, thanks so much. We will talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Sadie goes to see her rabbi and complains about terrible headaches. She whines, she cries, she talks about her unhappy life and her children and all the problems for hours and hours. Suddenly, Sadie looks up astonished. "Rabbi, your holy presence has cured me. My headache is gone." To which the rabbi replies, "No, Sadie, it's not gone. I have it now." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week's portion from Deuteronomy is called Shoftim, Judges. It establishes a process for administering justice and includes one of the most powerful statements in all religious, philosophical, or ethical tradition. Tzedek, tzedek tirdof. Justice, justice you must pursue. In the Torah, which has no extra words, no kephel lashon, a repetition of a word means it has additional importance and power. Here the word for justice, tzedek, is repeated, emphasizing that justice is extraordinarily significant. We must be not only fair in life, but truly just. We must find a way to remove our own ego needs in any judging situation and seek not self-justification, but true justice. Sometimes we must even admit that our processes of justice can result in unjust decisions and unfair punishments. That, too, is part of seeking true justice, of being just. But even more than that, the Torah teaches that we must not only be just, but tirdof, pursue justice, chase after it, make it a goal for our own lives and our civilization. It is not enough to act well in a place where justice is not the norm. We must strive to change an unjust situation into a just one. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. Each of us must pursue true justice. It's easy to understand that for Jews, justice underlies everything good in society. Without justice, there is no peace. Without justice, there is no morality. Without justice, we simply cannot trust our leaders or our government to act well. Sometimes we need to be forcibly reminded that on many issues, injustice still remains. We have to continue to work seriously to rectify this, and so pursue justice. Be just, God commands. Never accept injustice as a permanent condition of life. Chase justice in your own life. Strive for justice in your organizations and institutions. Work for justice in your society. Then good will follow. This is a great and holy message in a society like ours, in which the pursuit of happiness sometimes seems to be the ultimate goal, but the better pursuit, indeed the most meaningful real pursuit for us, must be justice. May our actions and our words help make our society more just in this week and in the coming new year of 5785, now just, 4.5 weeks away. When we come back in a moment on Too Jewish, our guest, Jonathan Kaufman, explains just how Jews first came to China and changed, its entire economy and what happened to them later on. Hear all about it when we return in a moment right here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Aseinu, aseinu,
Israeli troops rescued a hostage from southern Gaza last week, the eighth Israeli captive held by Hamas, brought back alive by IDF forces since October 7th. Kaid Farhan al-Qadi, 52 years old, a Bedouin Israeli, the father of 11 from the southern city of Rahat, who worked as a security guard at Kibbutz Magen on the Gaza border, was captured by Hamas terrorists kidnapped during their October 7th brutalities. He was one of several Israeli Arabs taken hostage. Al-Qadi was rescued by Israel's elite Shayetet 13 unit from a tunnel and brought to a hospital for examination. His condition was reported stable and he was released. Today, the IDF and the ISA rescued the hostage Kaid Farhan al-Qadi, aged 52, from Rahat, abducted by the Hamas terrorist organization into Gaza October 7th, the Israel Defense Forces said. Israeli security forces will continue to operate with all means to bring home the hostages. The rescue operation came more than 2 months after Israeli troops last rescued hostages, four of them in central Gaza in early June. Among them, festival-goer Noah Argamani, who had become a symbol of the terrible hostage crisis. In total, Israel has rescued 8 hostages in 4 separate operations. More than 100 were freed in the ceasefire deal way back in November, shortly after the war started. Israel has also retrieved the bodies of some of the hostages murdered in Gaza, including 6 brought back in an operation last week. The hostages' bodies, when they were examined, indicated they had been shot while captive in Gaza by Palestinian terrorists. Israel estimates that slightly more than 100 hostages remain in Gaza. At least 34 are thought to be dead. Families of hostages and their supporters have rallied for a ceasefire deal that will free the remaining hostages. Talks between Israel and Hamas have stalled repeatedly and are reported to still be existing, but moving slowly. Kaid's return home is nothing short of miraculous. The Hostage Families Forum, a group representing many of the captive families, said. However, we must remember, military operations alone cannot free the remaining 108 hostages who have suffered 326 days of Palestinian abuse and terror. A negotiated deal is the only way forward. We urgently call on the international community to maintain pressure on Hamas to accept the proposed deal and release all hostages. Back in December, al-Qadi's brother and son traveled to Los Angeles to speak in front of a mural painted to raise awareness of the hostages. While there, they met with local officials and Muslim leaders to press for the hostages' release. While in captivity, he had a grandson born. Around a third of non-Jewish college students embraced patterns of ideas hostile to Jews or Israel during the 2023-2024 academic year, according to a new study by Brandeis University researchers. The study, published last week by the university's Maurice and Marilyn Cohen Center for Modern Jewish Studies, paints a clearer picture of the attitudes undergirding the widespread tensions over Israel and Gaza that spread across U.S. campuses last year, leading to disruptive protests and university crackdowns. Study found that about 15% of students surveyed were hostile to Israel, many believing, for example, that Israel has no right to exist. It also found that nearly a quarter of non-Jewish students overall said they do not want to be friends with people who support Israel's existence as a Jewish state, a stance the survey said had the effect of ostracizing nearly all of their Jewish peers. The survey found that 16% of non-Jewish students were hostile to Jews, but not to Israel, believing in enduring anti-Semitic ideas such as that Jews have too much power in America. 2% of respondents were hostile to both Jews and Israel and exhibited the highest rate of anti-Semitic attitudes. Most non-Jewish students, 66%, were not hostile either to Jews or Israel, the survey said. Len Sachs, the study's co-author, said dealing with campus anti-Semitism is a solvable problem, but the universities and the Jewish community need to do a better job of understanding the varied ways in which non-Jews think about Jews and Israel. We do not find a climate of universal anti-Jewish hatred, nor do we find that Jewish students' concerns about anti-Semitism are unfounded. Sachs and his co-authors conclude, instead, we find that Jewish students' experiences of a hostile environment on campus driven by a minority but significant share of students who hold patterns of beliefs that are hostile towards Israel and or Jews. The researchers also asked about whether students engaged in pro-Palestinian advocacy on their campuses. They found that 17% of students reported attending an event supporting Palestinians last year, and 23% reported posting pro-Palestinian content on social media. 9% reported engaging in pro-Israel activity, either in person or on social media. Not the greatest balance. The survey found that progressive beliefs and support of the idea that all land seized through colonization should be returned to indigenous peoples had strong correlation with hostility to Israel. Nearly 90% of those classified as hostile to Israel, but not Jews, identified as liberal or very liberal. Those classified as hostile to Jews, but not Israel, were more politically diverse. 16% were conservative, 31% moderate, and 53% liberal or very liberal, similar to the overall breakdown of students' political identities. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back the Two Jewish, Jonathan Kaufman. He is a very distinguished Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, director of journalism now at Northeastern University. He worked in senior positions at Bloomberg News, The Wall Street Journal, The Boston Globe. He's executive editor for Company News at Bloomberg and has written some remarkable books, A Hole in the Heart of the World, about being Jewish in Eastern Europe, The Broken Alliance, Turbulent Times Between Blacks and Jews in America, which is certainly something relevant right now, and then the book we started talking about earlier today, The Last Kings of Shanghai. Jonathan, tell us about where the Sassoons and Kadouris came from and how they ended up in China.
Well, they start out in Baghdad, which is actually, we first read about these Jews in the Bible, because Baghdad was Babylon.
Yeah.
And when we read in the Bible about the Jews being kidnapped by Nebuchadnezzar and brought to Babylon, and that by the rivers of Babylon they wept when they remembered Zion, when they remembered Jerusalem. And while that's true, these Jews have been kidnapped, and they may have been weeping when they went to services on Saturday. The rest of the time, they were doing extraordinarily well. The Jews who settled in Babylon were very useful to the various rulers. They helped them with trade. They became almost like members of the Treasury Department as the various rulers of Baghdad extended their power throughout the Middle East. And in fact, the Jewish population became so important that the Pasha basically named one member of the community to sort of be the leader and would meet with them on a regular basis. And whenever this Jewish leader was brought to the palace to meet with the Turkish leaders or the Persians, everybody would bow their head respectfully when his sedan chair kind of passed through the streets. And this was the Sassoon family. The Sassoons became incredibly wealthy, had this incredible trade network. And then in the 1820s, 1830s, as often happens in Jewish history, politics turned against these Jews. And they began being kidnapped by the government, held for ransom. And the David Sassoon, who was the kind of patriarch of the family, was 37. He was about to take over the family enterprise. And he was kidnapped and jailed, and they were asking for a ransom. His father ransomed him out, but realized that things were only going to get worse. So he hustled his son down to the water, put him on a small boat that he had bought, and sent him off on his way, leaving his family behind, leaving his children behind, his wife. And so David Sassoon, who had expected to be the head of this great trading empire in Baghdad, spent his first night out of Baghdad in a warehouse with rats skittering along the floor, and had to start an entire new life.
You know, some of us in America only know the name Sassoon from Vidal Sassoon, a distant relative, and his hair care products. The Sassoon family was eventually extremely influential. And tell us about how, like, trading developed in China, the Bund, like, how all of that played out.
Well, I think one of the things that's complicated about this history is that the Sassoons did become incredibly wealthy and influential. and their fortune was built on opium. That's something that I think, you know, is maybe difficult to think about. We like to think that, you know, Jews involved in business are more ethical than others. But the fact was, the Sassoons were really British imperialists. One of the things David Sassoon decided when he finally washed up in India, having escaped Baghdad, was that the British Empire was going to be the future. He arrived in India just as the British were expanding their empire. And he decided that he would try to make a success there. And very quickly, he became a millionaire. He was able to get his family out of Baghdad, move them to India. And then opium at the time, we have to remember, was legal. It was grown in India, and it was sold in China. And the Chinese empire was furious about that. They didn't want opium to come in, and they felt it was, you know, addicting their citizens, and it was a terrible, terrible scourge. Just think of what opioids are like today in America and elsewhere. There was a great deal of feeling that the opium trade was harming the Chinese. But there was a lot of money to be made, and in fact, the British went to war, where they defeated China in the 1840s and basically opened up China to trade from the West. Much as today, people very much wanted to trade with China. There was a lot of money to be made there. And so the Sassoons were very good business folks. They were able to buy opium in India, then ship it to China to sell it there. And they used sort of technological innovations of the time. So while their competitors were using sailing ships to sail from India to Hong Kong or Shanghai, the Sassoons invested in steamships, which got the opium there a lot faster. They invested in telegraphs, which allowed them to communicate with each other. There were eight brothers who their father sent them across China and could communicate with them by telegraph to control the opium trade. And they were so successful that by the 1870s, 1880s, the Sassoons controlled the opium trade. And years later, when the communists took over Shanghai and seized the Sassoon business records, I was able to see them. And the Sassoons made probably $1 billion from their trade in opium and used that to fund a lot of their other ventures.
The Kadouris, kind of the same track?
No, the Kadouris were different. So one of the things the Sassoons realized, they were based in India, but they wanted to expand across China. And they were trying to figure out, how do you do that? How do you create these offices? How do you trust people? And so one of the things they did was they sent word back to Baghdad and said to families, Jewish families, if you send your sons, they were always sons, to work for us, we'll make sure that they get trained, that they have a school. The Sassoons built Jewish hospitals, Jewish cemeteries, even synagogues in China, which meant that they could bring over Jews from Baghdad who were loyal to them, who would work for the family, but also could have a Jewish life in China. And so the Kadouris had been a kind of a successful family, but their father died. And their mother was worried about the future of the family and of her sons. So she sent two of her sons to work for the Sassoons in India. And Eli Kadouri, who became the patriarch of the Kadouri family, left home at 15, made his way to India, and at 18 was sent by the Sassoons to Shanghai, and then north of Shanghai to work in one of their offices. And Eli Kadouri realized very early on as a young man there was a lot of money to be made in China. I mean, it was almost like the Silicon Valley of its day. If you landed in China in the 1880s, 1890s, there was a great deal of money to be made. So he quit the Sassoons, made his way to Hong Kong, started buying and selling stocks, eventually started building hotels. Today, the Kadouri family is the richest Western family in China. They're worth about $13 billion. And it all starts from investments that they started making in the 1880s, 1890s.
So they created the remarkable Bund, you know, the trading center. It became this commercial center, and Shanghai was the driving economic force of China. All of that, you know, obviously changed. First the Japanese occupation, and then the communist takeover. What happened to these families?
Well, it's interesting. So both the Sassoons and the Kadouris were very successful. And in fact, Victor Sassoon was the playboy who built that hotel that I visited when I first went there. Starting in the 1920s, 1930s, his hotel was so renowned that Noel Coward would visit there. Wallace Simpson, who would end up seducing the King of England.
The King of England, right.
There.
Yeah.
and would be photographed often nude, only wearing a life jacket. Shanghai was an exotic place. It was a little bit naughty. And Victor Sassoon's hotel was just a place everyone wanted to go. But starting in the late 1930s, new people are coming to Shanghai. And these are Jews who are fleeing Nazism. The Nazis had obviously taken over Germany. They had spread into Austria. Jews were in a panic. They were trying to leave. And as we know, every place was shut off to them. They were not allowed to escape to the U.S., to Britain. All the doors were being closed except Shanghai. Because Shanghai was occupied and carved up by the British, by the U.S., by the French, by the Germans and others, there was really no functioning government in Shanghai. And that meant if you were a Jewish refugee trying to flee the Nazis, if you could make it to Shanghai, you would be safe. You could settle there. And so these cruise ships start arriving, and instead of kind of rich people from Europe or Charlie Chaplin or others who had come before, there were all these Jewish refugees, ultimately 18,000 of these refugees from Berlin, from Vienna, arrive in Shanghai. Now, the Kadouris and the Sassoons are probably the two wealthiest families in Shanghai. They really are part of the elite, and suddenly all these Jews are showing up. But I think they recognize that there is a connection. Even though they're, you know, many oceans away, they're much wealthier. They see what's happening in Europe. And it really remarkably, both families try to help. Victor Sassoon, the playboy, begins to, you know, hire a lot of these refugees. He turns over a lot of his housing so they can find a place to stay. At one point, he even flies to South America to try to buy land where these Jews could be resettled. And most importantly, he keeps on negotiating with the Japanese. The Japanese have encircled Shanghai at this point. They've already invaded China. They've encircled Shanghai. They're allied with the Nazis. And there's this great fear that the Japanese will come in and destroy the Jewish community. But Victor Sassoon kind of cons them a little bit. He invites them to, you know, come to my clubs, come to my hotel. And then he has his own waiters spy on them and report on them. He'll say, maybe I'll invest in your companies. And as a result, the door remains open in Shanghai. And ultimately, 18,000 Jews are settled there. Eventually, the Japanese catch on to what's going on. And Victor Sassoon has to flee. He flees to India before he's arrested. The Kadouris are not so lucky. The Kadouris see all these refugees arriving, and they want to help them. And so they set up a school for children, because entire families are coming over. So they set up a school for children. They hire many of these refugees to be teachers there, to have sports activities, to really try to give these kids a normal childhood in the middle of China. And there are many people that you know, we find today, people like Michael Blumenthal, who was the Treasury Secretary under Carter, Larry Tribe, a professor at Harvard, Peter Max, the famous
graphic artist and artist, yeah.
All of them were children in Shanghai, and they were going to this school. But unfortunately, the Kadouris stayed too long. And after Pearl Harbor, the Japanese march into Shanghai. They go to the Peace Hotel. They take over Victor Sassoon's office. They are now in charge. And they arrest the Kadouris and put them in various camps during the course of the war. And Eli Kadouri, the patriarch, actually dies in Japanese imprisonment because they weren't able to get out in time.
Just one last question, Jonathan. By the way, terrific book. You wrote about the breakdown in the Black Jewish Alliance, which was so central in the civil rights movement, and many other things. This is such a challenging moment now, and particularly for Black Jewish relations. You're kind of an expert on this from your research and your writing. What do you see right now?
Well, I think what we're seeing is something that frankly has been true for a long time. You know, there is no Jewish community, right? There are Jews who support Netanyahu. There are Jews who oppose him. There are Jews who vote for Democrats. There are Jews who vote for Republicans. I think in the same way among African Americans, you have a lot of different feelings about Israel, about Gaza, about what's going on with the Palestinians. I think for sure, you know, among more left-wing African Americans, there is this feeling of solidarity with the Palestinians, and also a feeling that Israel's role in the Gaza war has been, you know, disastrous, and they're very critical of it. At the same time, I think if we look at many influential Black politicians, like Barack Obama, like Kamala Harris, these are Black politicians who want to preserve the ties between Blacks and Jews. They understand how important Jews are to the liberal coalition, to the Democratic Party. And I think that what we're seeing now is kind of a point at which Blacks and Jews, you know, the different parts of each community are trying to figure out what they're going to do. And so while I think it's been a very tough year, obviously, for American Jews, and I think we're going to see more and more criticism, I think we have to remember that when Kamala Harris, you know, steps forward with her Jewish husband, when Barack Obama, who had the first Passover Seder in the White House, steps forward, when a lot of Black business leaders, very influential Black business leaders, talk about the Jewish community and talk about Israel, that there is room for cooperation there. I think my concern is that I think there has long been a kind of resentment among certain aspects of the Black community, maybe especially in universities, with kind of Jewish success and with support for Israel. And I think that's becoming much more pointed. But I think we have to keep in mind that these are, while they're troubling voices, these encampments, these protests that we've been seeing are maybe 50 students, maybe 100 students. At my university, it was 40 students. But then when you talk to the kind of larger mass of students, you know, they want to understand what's going on in the Middle East. They support a two-state solution. So I think we have to be careful on both sides, Blacks and Jews, not to let the most extreme elements of both sides define where we are, but look kind of for the center and look for ways in which Blacks and Jews can continue to cooperate, or where we disagree, cannot let that completely rupture the relationship. Because in the end, when Blacks and Jews work together, I think as we've seen the civil rights movement, in Obama's election, in the support for Israel from the Black Caucus for many years, it's better for both communities.
Great advice. Jonathan, where can people go to find out more about The Last Kings of Shanghai and about you?
Well, you can certainly Google me, and you can Google the book, The Last Kings of Shanghai. It's for sale on Amazon. It's in your local bookstore. Yes, I say, I mean, I have a vested interest, obviously, but it reads like a novel, but it's all true.
It's a great read, but it's fascinating history. Thanks so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Cohan. Join us next week when our guest will be the outstanding journalist Abigail Pogrebin and Rabbi Dov Linzer discussing their new book together, It Takes Two to Torah. And join us, please, at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night. Services in Oreg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, 2, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and available on our Facebook page. And sign up now for This Is Judaism, a wonderful free class on everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism but didn't get the chance to ask. Play us out this morning. Here's the greatest klezmer clarinetist of all, Giora Feidman, playing Yossel Yossel. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.